يا حسين 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 يا حسين 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 يا حسين 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 يا حسين حسين حسين
أنت إمامي إليك انتمائي منك قريب في كربلاء في كربلاء.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله الذي لا يبلغ مدحته القائلون ولا يحصي نعماءه العادون ولا يؤدي حقه المجتحدون الذي لا يدركه بعد الحمم ولا يناله غوص الفطن ثم الصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين حبيب قلوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا وشفيع ذنوبنا سيدنا ومولانا أبي القاسم محمد. وعلى بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين صاحب العصر والزمان خليفة الرحمن إمام الإنس والجان ولعن الله وعداهم أجمعين إلى يوم الدين. أما بعد، فقد قال الله وقوله الحق. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. ظهر الفساد في البر والبحر بما كسبت أيدي الناس ليذيقهم بعض الذي عملوا لعلهم يرجعون. صدق الله العلي العظيم. Our attempt since day number one with all of you in this first 10 days or 11 days of Muharram was to introduce a lifestyle, some clarity and some focus in our lives, and not to simply follow the norm as it is, but stop and contemplate and be conscious of how we're living our life. We've spoken about minimalism now for the past 10 to 11 nights, and doing my best to exhaust the topic to the best of my ability. I'm grateful for your patience. I'm grateful for you coming along with me on this journey. And tonight, I wanted to speak a little bit about a few practical steps that we can take in our life to begin this process. You see, it's one thing to be enlightened, either by subject matter or by content or by lectures. It's one thing now to take that enlightenment and convert it to reformation. It's one thing to sit in a 45 to a 50 minute discussion, and maybe perhaps for you it was relatable. I had several people come to me throughout the first 10 days and tell me that it felt like you were talking about me directly. It felt like you knew my story, Sayyid. And, you know, I made a point last year on my last lecture in my ashra last year. I want to make here tonight with all of you, because in my discussion with the youth or with families or even with elders, if it's one thing that I'm a little bit concerned about, not just here, everywhere, in all of us, myself included, is that we haven't quite understood Islam to be that solution, right? I haven't quite grasped it to be the first place I should go to as an outlet for my problems. Because in reality, I think that when some of you have presented these problems to others, you haven't been given the best response. Or you've been told that, look, you don't worship enough. If you worship more, then you wouldn't have these array of problems. And that's either turned you off, or it's made you believe that the deen is one-dimensional. The fact that a lot of you have come to me and said that you know, you use the words relatable, or you use the word that, you know, it's modern, or it's current, this discussion that we had. The reality is that I never said anything outside the deen. I really want my youth today to understand this point. If you get nothing out of tonight, just get this one initial point, then you can sleep or rest or go on your phone, that's fine. Just get this point from me. Nothing I've said out of my own opinion, everything I've attempted to present to all of you has been from the deen. The words of Allah, from the words of the Ahlul Bayt, from the Aql of the Insan. So if you believe that for a moment the content that was presented to all of you was relatable, was current, was something that you could actually, you know, understand in 2019, then understand that's the deen talking to you, it's not me talking to you. Which means what? That the deen has always been relatable, has always been current in whatever era you live in. The deen hasn't changed. It's not like the deen has come down in 2019 to be a different deen. Right? As I said last year, it's not like, you know, all of a sudden, you know, I got a wahi of a couple of new ayat of the Quran that I presented to all of you. No. In fact, a lot of the ayat that I presented to all of you, you had mashallah memorized. I would begin the first half, you from the crowd would finish the second half. So it's not mind-blowing material, right, that I presented to all of you. They're simple reminders for you and I. But what I really want all of you to understand was, it is the deen that is relatable. It's the deen that's modern. It's the deen that's current. Because sometimes when I hear people say that, you know, if the Sharia was revealed in 2019, it will look nothing like the Sharia 1400 years ago. That's a very concerning statement for someone like me. So right away, you know, we have labeled the deen to be something that's prehistoric, outdated, right? Needs a revival a little bit, or needs, let's say, an update. So if ever you have, you know, felt like these discussions were something that could really help you in your life, that's the deen talking. So let's change our perspective when it comes to the deen and take it as a deen that is relevant and current in every era. The deen will always tell you that, look, I am the same way I've been since day number one. The difference is that now we are in a state in the first 10 days to what? To listen to that deen, to approach that deen. And that's why these 10 days are always and were very, very vital to all of us. Now, practical steps for to live a life of minimalism, there's several. I just want to spend maybe, you know, two or three of them tonight with all of you to try to make this discussion a little bit more practical. Because really, you know, if you and your family have sat down and discussed about what's been talked about the past 10 nights, and you've come to the conclusion that, okay, let's make a change together, the four of us, the five of us, the six of us, then there are steps. And the first step that I want to present to all of you is that this is a lifestyle change. It's not a three-week trial run, it's not a six-month plan. This is a complete and absolute lifestyle change. Look, if you wake up one day and say, look, I'm going to start to lose a few pounds, okay? Start the weight loss program. And however you want to do it, some people count their calories, some people take on intermittent fasting, some people, I don't know, begin their keto diets, whatever diet fits for you, every diet will always tell you the exact same thing. Any plan of weight loss will always tell you the exact same thing, that this is a lifestyle change, correct? Yeah. It's not that you just kind of do this for 6 months, go back to your previous life, and everything will be fine. No, it's a complete overhaul of a life. So imagine now to lose 5 kilos, you need to overhaul your life. If that's the case for 5 kilos, how about lightening our soul, or getting to God, or finding that contentment? That doesn't require a lifestyle change. It does. And that has to be first the mindset going in. This now will be a new normal for us as a family. And if we're serious about it, we'll embrace that new normal. That's point number one. Point number two, practically, this is very, very specific, and I'll back it up with Nahjul Balagha. I want all of us now to begin to do a little bit of muhasaba, a little bit of accountability, okay? It's a big word, it's a big concept, to be accounted for yourself is huge. But very specifically, I want all of us to account for our social gatherings. Please follow me for a moment, okay? Our social gatherings, where we go socially, be it weddings, or be it parties, or be it functions, right? Stop and think for a moment, do I always have to say yes to every invitation? Because there are some functions that we go to that we know are hosted by people who are well off, or people who live a very consumerism-based life. And I know for sure that this is his function, or his daughter's wedding, or whatever the case may be, or a graduation party, and he's gonna go all out for his daughter. And I am trying to live a life of minimalism. And yes, I'm sorry, our social gatherings affects this process of a new life. As it is, we should be very careful with where we go, especially take our children. In Nahjul Balagha, letter number 45, very famous letter that Imam Ali alayhi salatu wassalam, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad. He writes to Uthman ibn Hunayf. Uthman ibn Hunayf was the governor of Basra during Amir al-Mu'mineen's Khilafat al-Zahiri. It's a very beautiful letter, it's a very lengthy letter, but the initial few paragraphs is all that I want to bring your attention to. The story says that Uthman ibn Hunayf was invited by some very, very well-off individuals in Basra. You know, sometimes, you know, if you're somebody who is, you know, who wants to show who you know and what you know and what level you're at, you'll invite, you know, the people of influence inside of your city or your town to show others, look, this is who I know. This is the governor now of Basra. So naturally now these guys whose only purpose of these functions is to show off their wealth and show off their prestige and show off their power, they invite the governor of the time. So they invited Uthman ibn Hunayf. And he accepted that invitation and actually attended the program. News got back to Amir al-Mu'mineen that a governor of yours attended such a function. And he wrote him a letter, basically summarizing that you had no business being at such a function. A function like that was only made to elevate those who are already elevated in their own eyes. To inflate an ego that's already been inflated. There were no individuals who were of a lower class. There was no talk of feeding the poor. No. You just kind of feed those people who really are eating very well every single day anyways. And he describes to them that, you know, he describes to him that, you know, if there is a mola on top of you, a leader that you have to answer to, then know that that mola also has a leader on top of him as well. Meaning what? That you are accountable. You're accountable to me as your Khalifa, as your Imam. I am accountable to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And he goes on to say very importantly, if I had more time I'd expand, but I don't. He says that there are certain, there are certain aspects of my life that you can never emulate, Ibn Hunayf. You can't. You can't live off of coarse garments. You can't live off two pieces of bread. He says that specifically in the letter. Letter number 45, Nahjul Balagha. But what you can do is emulate me in my righteousness, in my simplicity. So the one message that we get from, of many, now he goes on to talk a little bit in the letter, but one message which is related to our discussion right now, point number two, is that not every function you and I should be found at. I ask those of you, especially my youth who are on the verge of getting married, maybe you're somebody who is going to begin the planning stages of your wedding ceremony after Ashura, I don't know. But if you are at that stage, I humbly ask you to please be very careful. Hadith says that Allah tests us in two occasions the most. Extreme happiness, extreme grief. Sometimes there's nothing more happier for a family than a wedding inside the family. It's a beautiful environment. The family comes together, people from out of town come, and the house is full, mashallah, every day there's something going on. You know, there's always some sort of, you know, mashallah, some good chaos. There's, you know, there's selling and there's buying and there's packaging and there's everything. Very nice mahal. And that's beautiful. That's how it should be. But this is your one opportunity to begin your life with your new spouse on a right foot. I oftentimes tell this to my young couples in Toronto. I'll say it to all of you as well, if you don't mind. And if you do, it's okay. I'm leaving tomorrow. Doesn't matter. I choose these topics very carefully. Anyways, your first wedding invitation, on the envelope, it has two, then it has a blank line. Write Imam al-Zamana on that wedding invitation. The very first person I want you to invite to your wedding is our 12th Imam. And ask yourself, if I give him this invitation, will he come? I tell you, no word of a lie. People come to me and they give me their wedding invitation. And they say, Maulana, I know you won't come. There's music, it's mixed, no hijab, but here's an invitation anyways. And I'll say, look, keep your invitation. You can use it for somebody else, but I won't be there. But thank you very much for you to actually admit the fact that this is what I'm going to be hosting now. And I know it's a big debate about mixed gatherings and not my topic, don't worry. I don't want to go down that route. It's not my job. That's the resident alim in this city to do that, not me. But this idea that every function, you know, especially if you are a family who's really trying to be a pious family, and you're careful about who you mingle with and who you hang out with and who you spend time with, you don't need to go to every single function. Because sometimes in those functions, you end up meeting people where all they talk about are their possessions. All they talk about is their last vacation trip. All they talk about are the various properties. And sometimes they don't even know what they're saying sometimes. Right? It's called rich talk. You know, they say it so randomly. You're like, whoa, what'd you say? A villa, a cottage, you know, a beach house, a summer house. Like they're common words. And you're thinking, wow, that's so common. Why isn't it common for us? These are small things, I tell you, but they really have a huge impact. I ask you humbly, please, you don't need to go everywhere you're invited. Especially if you know that this event or this function has nothing to do with Islam. Yes, they'll have the ceremonial hadith al-kissa or maybe a surah, and then mashallah, the party will begin. Just to kind of see, okay, we at least had hadith al-kissa. Especially if, like I said, you and your spouse and your kids have made a conscious effort to now start a new normal. Okay? Again, not my words, Amir al-Mu'mineen, letter number 45, Nahj al-Balagha. You don't need to go to every function. If you're going to represent me as a governor, you should not be found in such functions. If we want to be his Shia, we should not be found in such functions. I'm sorry. It's a bitter truth. We can't have it both ways. Sometimes we want the best of both worlds, right? We can't have it. Once we make a decision, we have to sacrifice a little bit. Sacrifice a little bit. And if that sacrifice means that we begin to kind of pick and choose, have a filter of our functions, then so be it. But part of the process of implementing a life of a minimalist is to check your gatherings, check your circle, check the people that you spend time with. Not just for the youth, for my elders too. You know, these family friends of yours, find out, are we kind of like a ham fikr with the same thought pattern or not? Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Point number three I want to talk about is gratitude. Okay? Thankfulness. It's a huge topic again. The power of gratitude is something the West is really kind of, you know, really pushing nowadays. To the point where even those of us who suffer from, you know, mental health issues, we have anxiety, we have stress, we have depression. One of the ways that the West now is introducing coping methods is to have a journal of gratitude or a gratitude journal. Where you legitimately have a journal at your side table before you go to bed, you write down everything you are thankful for that day. Okay, that's supposed to help you cope with stress and anxiety. And it's a beautiful, beautiful idea and a beautiful habit. But it's nothing new to the deen. The deen talks about gratitude from the very, very basis of the deen. Meaning what? One of the things that we use to prove this desire we have to understand God. One of the things that we use that drives us to investigate God is our innate need for thankfulness. I'll give you a very simple example for my small kids here in the audience. A very simple example, I'm sorry. You know, we were learning this stuff in the first year of the Hawza in our Darsi Tamhidiya. A small little book called The 50 Lessons for Youth when it comes to beliefs, the usul of the deen, aqaid. When it came to the discussion on Allah, a nice little example. I like to use that with you guys tonight. The example says, I want you to imagine that somebody drops an envelope full of cash at your doorstep with your name on it and leaves it there. Okay? You open the door now, and there in front of you is this big wad of cash, envelope of cash, has your name on it. And the first thing you do is you look around and make sure, you know, who gave this to me, what's happening. And the very first thing that you're going to do is you're going to do your level best to find out who it was. Please follow the example, who it was. If not for anything else, you just want to thank them. Show your appreciation. Not only do we have this innate need to thank, we also have this innate need to receive thanks too as well. Part of the reason why sincerity is so difficult, the highest level of pure sincerity, is because there's always an element inside every act that we do where I want to be thanked or appreciated or recognized. And we have to fight that need and understand that I don't want the thanks from you, I want the thanks from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But inside the discussion on aqaid and khudashinasi and understanding God, this example is often used. So we will go to the ends of the earth to find out who could have possibly dropped off a wad of cash at my door. Maybe it was him, maybe it was her. So you call your friends, you call your family. You do everything you can just to thank them. Now I want you to imagine someone calls you and says, look, that wad of cash that you have, I'll triple that wad of cash if you give me your right arm, for example. If you give me sight out of one eye. If you give me your sense of hearing, triple the amount of cash, meaning you're set for life. Nobody in this room would be willing to make that deal at all. So we are, you know, bending over backwards to thank somebody for a wad of cash, but one thing that is not negotiable, meaning our senses, our limbs, our inhale, our exhale, we're not bending over backwards to thank them or not. We are. And innately, we're looking for that entity that what? That provided us with all of these huge blessings, leading us towards God. So gratitude actually is a bridge and a path to where? To God. Gratitude also makes you realize how much you have. The focus now goes from what I have to what I don't have. The focus goes from what I have as opposed to going to what I don't have. And minimalism is a refocusing of what I have, not being obsessed with things that I don't have. And part of the process is to be grateful. Like, you know, my experience here in the East, my very first Muharram in the East in Africa, and I did my best to go as much places as I can, just, you know, driving around town, looking at the locals, and hearing some of the problems of the locals, especially as you go a little bit further out of the main city center. And you look at these people and the way they live their life and how they conduct themselves. The positivity, the smile, you know, just moving on with your life even though they have the bare minimum and, bare minimum things in their life makes me realize that, you know, our problems in the West are nothing. It's a joke. The things that we cry about and complain about back home is nothing compared. There are people who don't have water unless they walk 10 miles. If I lose one bar on my Wi-Fi, it's Qiyamah. Right? Hashtag first world problems. That only happens when you begin to kind of realize that, look, I have it made very, very easy. That happens from thankfulness. Now, how do you thank? Now we know. Allah says, "In shakartum la azidannakum." If you thank me, I'll give you more. So if we want individuals, we want more, and we want to possess, and there's nothing wrong with wanting the finer things in life, inshallah, I've made that very clear to all of you. Why not go through the process of God as opposed to going through the process of the dunya? Why not let God allow the dunya to come and fall at your feet? We talked about that in detail, I think, on Saturday. One of the areas and the processes and the equations to get God to bring things to you is to be thankful, okay? That all of you know. Now, how can we be thankful? There is a verbal expression, Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen, that's fantastic, that's very important. But there's an amali portion as well. Amali portion as well. And I want my parents in the audience, I'm with you, to begin to now really kind of, you know, show your kids how to be grateful for everything that they do. This is where comparison actually is a good thing. To compare what you have as opposed to what someone else doesn't have who is your age as well. Now, the amali portion is very simple. The equation is that if you use God's blessings for what it was meant to be used for, Allah will increase those blessings. Right? Heard it 1,000 times? Let me give you one simple example. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Now, I want you to imagine, it's an example I used before in Toronto. I want you to imagine that a friend of yours has gone to the mall. Okay? And he comes across a store or a shirt, let's say, that he knows that you would love. So he buys it for you. It's not your birthday, it's not any special occasion, it's not Eid. No. From the mall, he goes to your house. He says, "My friend, I saw this shirt. I thought about you. You look amazing in this shirt. You know, for no apparent reason, I just want to come and drop it off." You're like, "Oh my God, thank you so much. So sweet of you. So nice of you. What a true friend you are. What a true brother you are." You really, really, really are thankful. You cannot stop verbally thanking him. You take the shirt, he goes back home. You think to yourself, how can I thank this friend of mine properly? The best way to thank anybody is to feed them. That's the best way to do it. Right? That's the best way to do it. So you say, why don't you and your family come over for dinner? Have some nice mishkaki. We'll have a good time. Come around 7 o'clock. Tika? He arrives at 6:30, half an hour early. He comes in. You're not quite ready for him, but it's okay. He's a good friend here. Come on in. And he sees that your son is busy, what? Dusting off the table. And you look inside the hand of that son that's dusting the table, and you see that that's the shirt that I bought him last week. And you're like, "No, it can't be." And you keep looking, and he's dusting away, mashallah, putting every effort into it. And then you think, "Bana, come here for a second. Is that the shirt I bought you?" He goes, "Yes, it is. You know what? It picks up dust very, very well." "Yeah, I ran out of dust rags. I had no idea what to do until I discovered this shirt that you bought me. And oh my God, look at the table's brand new." Like, "Oh, okay, okay." And you're clenching your teeth the entire night. "I can't believe this guy used the shirt I bought him to what? To dust a table. And has the gall to say it's an amazing dust rag. I didn't buy it for a dust rag." Now, the very next week, you're back at the mall again because your wife drags you there every single week. And you find a pair of pants that would go perfect with that shirt that you bought your friend. But do you buy it? No, you don't. "I'm not going to buy him anything now anymore. Forget it." Why? He's not using it for what it was meant to be used for. On the flip side now, let's say a week after you give him the shirt, there's a big jashan here at the mosque. And you're sitting there in the mosque, and your friend walks in. He is wearing the shirt. "Oh, he's glowing, you're glowing. I can't believe you wore the shirt. It looks amazing. Beautiful, you look great." And now the very next week when your wife drags you and you see those pants, instantly you buy them. When Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala goes to the mall to buy our blessings, He stops to think, you know, did He use it as a dust rag or did He wear the shirt at the jashan? Did He use His tongue, let's say, to praise me or for backbiting? He used His ears to listen to dua and munajat to elevate the love of Allah and the Ahlul Bayt? Or were those ears for something else? The eyes were for something else? The heart was for something else? Part of the process of gratitude is the idea that we have to show it in an amali maidan. Remember the story of the Ibn Ziyad brothers I mentioned a few nights ago. Imam Ali walks into a mansion and says, you can have the exact same mansion in Jannah if you use this mansion for its proper purposes. Inviting your family, feeding the poor, having barakat, maybe the dhikr of Hussein inside the house. All that can what? Can segue into a mansion inside the hereafter. Because you use that mansion for what it was meant to be used for, to increase your iman. Gratitude is very, very important. And I'm sorry, sometimes we have a misconception. The misconception is that we think we should thank Allah for everything that I have been given. And sometimes we don't understand that we should thank Allah sometimes for those things that I have not been given either. I thank Allah for every difficulty, every test. I thank Allah for every hardship that has come my way. I thank Allah for those hardships that He blocked from coming my way as well. I thank Allah when I lose my job, because I'm grateful to Him. I thank Allah when I land my job as well. Because sometimes Allah tests us not only by taking things away, but by giving it to us as well. Oh, it's very dangerous. You want that promotion? You begged your boss? Fine, I'll put one extra zero on your salary. Let's see what you do with that extra zero. All of a sudden now that extra zero means not so much at the mosque anymore. So sometimes, you know, we complain, how could God take that away? And sometimes we need to say, how could God give me this as well? That's also gratitude. But the idea is that to have this sense of gratitude, to focus on what I own, what Allah has given me, what I have earned with my own hard work, that will eliminate the process of always talking about what I don't have. And that's the initial steps inside a life of minimalism. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad, please. The last point before Masaib is the idea of breaking the mold of a habitual life. Okay? Sometimes we make decisions habitually, as a habit. We do it subconsciously. Remember I talked about consciousness on Sunday, to be present in the moment, to know what we're doing. And sometimes we buy things, we go to the market, yeah, we need this, we go to the mall, online, click here, check out here. And before you know it, I have this hoarding problem of possessions. Out of habit. Now, there's a beautiful discussion, a lot of research on habits in general. Again, it requires an entire ashra. Just very briefly. How are habits formed? Habits have a three process, or a three-point cycle. Okay, the cycle of a habit. If you've done any research on habits, and sometimes, you know, those of you who are psych majors, or doing some counseling, or dealing with, I don't know, addiction problems, I'm sure you've done some research on habits. Habits have three ingredients to them. One is called the cue. Okay? One is called the route. One is called the reward. Something cues our habit, then we do the habit, then we're rewarded with the habit. So for example, there are people who work, let's say 9 to 5, 9 to 6. And every single day at 3:15, they have a break after lunch. Okay? And that's their smoke break, let's say, for example. So the moment that 3:15 hits, boom, you're on a break, you say, look, Brian, I'm on a break. I'm taking my 3:15. That's your cue. So you go outside the building, you light your cigarette, That is the route. And then the feeling you have of that cigarette is your reward. Okay? That's what a habit is. Cue, route, reward. Okay? Stay with me for a moment. They did some research, very, very quickly, did some research on some animals. And I get it. Those are animals, we're humans, but just, you know, let's take the crux of it. And what they did was they put a mouse inside of a little box, and they put cheese at the other side of the box. And they have wires on this bachata mouse, and they're, you know, just trying to see what's going on. The cue to his habit was they would lift up a piece of paper and he would go sniffing for the cheese. Okay? The route was for him to get to the cheese. The reward is the cheese itself. Okay? You guys are with me, inshallah? Okay, fantastic. The first time that they lifted the paper up, the mouse was sniffing around as they do. He has no idea what's going on. Inch a little bit forward, a little bit forward, a little bit forward. Finally, after a very long time, found the cheese. Okay? Did this experiment several times. By the end of it, the moment that the paper was lifted, he went straight left, cheese. Straight left, cheese, within seconds. Then they read the data. Very interesting data. Very interesting data. They measured his brain activity. The brain activity was the highest. It peaked on the papers at the cue stage and at the reward stage. And the lowest it was at, to the point where it could be he could be brain dead, was at the route idea. So cue, reward was high brain, route was low brain. Okay? Meaning what? He didn't need to use any brain activity to get to the cheese. It became muscle memory. So during the actual habit, they say the mouse uses very little brain. The cue excites him, the reward excites him. That 315 gets you popped up out of the chair. That last puff really makes you feel like you're in heaven. In between, however, it's just a habit. Like before I went to the Hausa, I used to work at a computer company, okay? I was an IT guy in the late 90s, early 2000s, okay? I worked 1 year overnight shift. Story I've told before. My shift would start at 10 p.m. and end at 8 a.m., okay? And I would drive home at the end of my shift at 8 a.m., be home by 9 a.m., be in bed by 9:01. So I was very tired when I got home. I did this for a year. I remember vividly there were moments at 8 a.m. that I would be driving home and I would get to my driveway. I think to myself, how did I get here? I mean, the moment my 8 a.m. shift was over, my cue began. I'm like, oh, I'm gonna get home. I'm so tired, tough shift, I'm so tired, I'm so tired, tough shift. And that moment that I climbed into bed, you know that moment when you climb into bed and you find that pillow spot? Oh, you toss, you turn, you finally, you sink, you're like, ya Allah, right? And then your kid comes in, says, Baba, are you sleeping? Yes, I was sleeping, yes. I was sleeping, that's okay though, what can I do? In between, however, I don't remember even driving home sometimes. It's very dangerous. But I got home. I made a left, I made a right, I went south, I got home. Meaning what? There was zero brain. I could have been asleep for all that matters. There was no brain activity. The scary part is when we engulf ourselves in habit, that's what happens. There's zero consciousness. Legitimately no brain activity inside of our brain. Right? Think about sometimes our salat. Why is it that people like me, Allahu Akbar, that's my cue? Great. And then my brain shuts off. Until what? Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Meaning my brain for salat shuts off. Everything else it's on, but not for salat. Why? It's a habit. It's a habit. And it should be a habit, but a conscious one. My point is that sometimes when we are living this life of consumerism, we don't even know we're doing it. Right? We do it as a habit. And because the brain activity is so low, I'm not conscious of it. Right? So the first thing that I want all of us to do is to examine our habits. What do I do habitually? And begin to kind of change that inside the entire family. Because having zero brain activity is in essence, you being ghafil. Ghafil. And ghaflat is a disease of the soul. Right? Imam Ali calls it the sleep of the heart, ghaflat. It's called heedlessness, not giving importance to something that you should give importance to. For example, there are people who sit in a majlis and they're wowed by the Maulana. Kya baat hai yaar, maza aaya aaj majlis mein. Beautiful. Beautiful points. Or a youth sits here and says, you know what, I'm going to begin to change myself now. That's it. Wallahi, from tomorrow it's going to be a new me. And you get up from the majlis, you go downstairs, you grab your mandazi, you head home, and everything is forgotten. You wake up in the morning, I have to go to school, I have my assignment, I have my exams, everything. You come back the same night, same process happened. We're wowed for 2 seconds, that's called heedlessness. It's called ghafla. Okay? It's a big discussion. The Quran talks about those who are ghafil, those who are not conscious, and talks about those people who are the motivation behind the hellfire. Last point, then Masai. وَلَقَدْ ذَرَأْنَا لِلْجَهَنَّمَا كَثِيرًا مِنَ الْجِنِّ وَالْإِنْسِ. Again, these are verses that a lot of you have memorized. But look at it through this lens now. لَهُمْ قَلُوبًا لَا يَفْقَهُونَ بِهَا وَلَهُمْ أَعْيُونٌ لَا يُبْصِرُونَ بِهَا وَلَهُمْ أَذَانٌ لَا يَسْمَعُونَ بِهَا أُولَٰئِكَ كَالْأَنْعَامِ بَلْ هُمْ أَضَلُّ أُولَٰئِكَ هُمُ الْغَافِلُونَ. Okay? From the men and the jinn who will be in the hellfire, they have three qualities. They have hearts, but nothing goes inside those hearts. It's all surface level. They have eyes. They can look at things, they can't see things. They have ears. They can hear things, they can't listen to anything. They're just like cattle, cows. Very specific imagery in the Quran. Balhum adal, they're worse than that. They're amongst the heedless ones. Why cows? Very quickly, and then Masai. I live north of the city in Toronto. That's where I live. If you travel a little bit north, there comes a moment where, inshallah, when you come to Toronto, you come to my house, you go north on a certain road. After a while, it's all farmland. Okay? It's all farmland. And I pass by cows almost every day on my way home from the center. It's beautiful. It really is beautiful. If you look at how the cow operates, it's not my topic, don't worry. But if you look at how the cow operates, every other animal, it seems, reacts to its surroundings. Okay? If you shoot a gun in the air, the birds will fly off. If you honk your horn loud enough, right? A dog might jump. A raccoon might not cross the road. A squirrel might do something. Every animal seems like it reacts to something around it, except for the cow. Kuch bhi nahi karta wo. He does nothing. You can drive 80, 100 miles an hour past the guy's head, he won't move from where he is. He really won't. He'll be munching on the grass. You know, you can scream in his ear, you can shoot a gun in the air, you can honk the horn. You can even tip him over. He'll tip just like that state. He won't move at all. Nothing. No matter what happens around him, nothing will affect him. The Quran says people who are ghafil are just like these cows. Doesn't matter what you do, how much you say, how much you warn them, heech, nothing will happen. Nothing will enter. That's what happens when we are what? Not conscious of what's happening. Right? That habit drops a level where we are brain dead, we're still going through the motions, right? So I ask you to please protect yourself and your family from that moment. So four steps, okay? Please, a lifestyle change, watch what functions you go to, gratitude, and what? And understanding our habits, inshallah. With that, inshallah, I pray for your success. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. A few moments of musibah. It's a shame sometimes that people like me think that after Ashura, this commemoration is over. When in reality, for Bibi Zainab and Imam Sajjad, it's now just begun. Many historians have said that what Bibi Zainab witnessed, the entire movement of Karbala, hatta even Imam Hussein didn't witness. If you look at the difficulty of Imam Sajjad, when he attempted now to defend his father before Asri Ashur, Imam Hussein said that your journey now will begin after Ashura, towards Kufa and Sham. And one thing that Imam Sajjad was obsessed about for 33 years after the day of Ashura, It's a lesson for you and I. Tonight is the ending of the first Ashra. Does not mean it's the ending of the gham and the tragedy that befell on the family of the Holy Prophet. Imam Sajjad was obsessed with ensuring that nobody would ever stop crying for his father. Crying tears for his father. When, if he was invited, let's say, to a happy occasion, he would first refuse and refuse and refuse. Finally, if he was to accept, he would say, look, if you want me to come, I want you to first invite a poet of our time, have him write a few couplets for my father, Hussein, and recite those couplets before the wedding ceremony. To the point where that poet would recite those couplets, Imam Sajjad would stop him and say, no, not like that. I want you to recite the poetry as if my father's mayyat is lying right now in front of you. He'd pass by an animal about to be sacrificed. He would go up to that man and say, you are in charge of this animal? Yes, yes, I am, Mawla. Have you given this animal some water? He says, Mawla, we never sacrifice our animals without water. And he begins to cry uncontrollably. Why? He says that this animal is given at least water before he sacrificed. My Muslim father was sacrificed thirsty and hungry on the plains of Karbala. When somebody would even complain to him, Mawla, bahut ho gaya, that's enough now. You've been crying for God knows how long. How much more are you going to cry? And he says very famously that you didn't do insaf with me. Nabi Yaqub and his son Nabi Yusuf were apart, some say for 40 years. Nabi Yaqub knew that Yusuf was alive, he just wasn't in front of him. And he cried until the whiteness of his eyes was gone. That's one son who's alive, just not in front of him. I lost 18 of my sons and my brothers in one day, in one afternoon. And you question my tears? It's a very difficult time now for the Ahlul Bayt. The morning of the 11th of Muharram, Umar bin Sa'd now is getting ready, this qafila, to go towards Kufa and then Sham. And the way that they had now mounted these individuals on the backs of camels, he would grab Imam Sajjad and he would put them on a saddleless camel. How difficult it is to ride for 5 minutes on an animal that doesn't have a saddle on it, let alone for what? For days. Chained up and shackled in the heat of the desert. They would use one rope to tie the entire family together. So either the young ones had to be yanked up to meet the height of the elders, or the elders had to drop down to meet the height of the young ones. But the most difficult moment that happened during this departure from Karbala was for Bibi Zainab. The same Zainab, very ajeeb story. My sisters look for a role model, she's your role model. When on the 2nd of Muharram, she heard that this place that they have stopped at is called Karbo Bala, she summoned Imam Hussein. Says, Bhaiya, this is Karbala? Yes, it is. We've arrived to Karbala? Yes. She began to cry so much that she lost consciousness. Imam Hussein, when he woke her up, he had a talk with her. Said, look, Zainab, you have to take my mission forward. You're my sharik, you're my partner in this. You have to now find the inner strength now to move forward. When she heard Karbala, she passed out. But after that talk, I don't know what he said to her, but she found this inner strength that took her all the way back to Medina, to the point where 70 steps from where her brother was about to be killed, until Zainabiyah, she stood there, but she never lost consciousness. She had that strength inside of her. Now this Zainab plays the role of Hussein, getting everybody ready for that journey towards Kufa and Sham. And there comes a moment where Umm Kulthum is standing there and Zainab is standing there. And Zainab says, Umm Kulthum, I'll mount you on the camel. Says, no, Shahzadi, I'll mount you on the camel. Bibi Zainab leans forward, sticks out her hand, some say sticks out her knee. Umm Kulthum now is mounted on the camel. And there on the plains of Karbala, Zainab stands there alone. The same Zainab in the 28th of Rajab, when they left Medina, the way that she exited the house, Ali Akbar was there, Qasim was there, Abbas was there, Allah Muhammad were there, Hussein was there, to the point where Ali Akbar himself would announce, please lower your eyes, the daughter of Fatima is about to exit her house. And when she came close to the horse, there were so many of her young Javan warriors there to mount her on the horse. If anything else, Imam Hussein came forward, says, Bana, let me mount you on the horse. But that was Medina Zainab, this is Karbala now. And she stands there by herself. And for a moment the Maqtal says that she looked towards the Maidan of Karbala. It doesn't say where she looked, but my heart tells me that she didn't look at Hussein or Ali Akbar or Ono Muhammad. Her eyes went to the banks of Farat and would say, Abbas, your Zainab is standing here about to mount the horse and you're not here beside me. I never thought that day would come where I would have to do things by myself with you as my brother standing beside me. سيعلم الذين ظلموا أي منقلب ينقلبون إنا لله وإنا إليه راجعون ماتم الحسين